I'm happy now to welcome to the show Noam Freshman. He is a junior at St. John's College here in Santa Fe, and Terrence Manning, who is a graduate of the St. John's Graduate Institute. And the two of them were part of a project called Planting the Tree of Peace in Georgia. We're talking about the Republic of Georgia. And we actually had Noam and a Georgian St. John's student called Elena Gvilia on before they left. Now you're back. You've done the project, and we are here to get a report. Welcome, gentlemen.
Thanks for having us.
So remind people, or maybe some didn't hear the first show that we did, what is this project about, Planting the Tree of Peace in Georgia?
Right. So Planting the Tree of Peace in Georgia is, first of all, a longstanding relationship where we got funding from the Davis Foundation. And the Davis Foundation, they try to support 100 projects from United World Colleges around the country to do projects for peace. So St. John's is kind of associated with the United World Colleges. And so St. John's College can apply for this funding. And this year our project received the funding.
And what was the idea? What were you going to do? And, in fact, what did you do in Georgia?
Yeah. So the project had many facets. So Georgia has a lot of conflict, political unrest. And so and it's deep-seated ever since they became independent from the Soviet republics. So what we did is we gave them a seminar, like a St. John's-style seminar, on the play Oresteia, the trilogy, which has to do with revenge. So we did a seminar, and then we also did formal nonviolent conflict resolution training and mediation. And then we did a medical mission where the students accompanied us and a group of doctors into refugee camps. And then the final kind of culminating factor was a political conference.
So you show up in Georgia and you say, hi, we're here to teach you some ancient Greek plays about revenge. I mean, how did you get these people together? What was the context in which you started teaching these seminars?
Yeah, the State Department runs a program all over the world called American Corners. And they're basically English learning centers. And so they have one in Zugdidi, which is the town that we were staying in and conducting the project in. Zugdidi is right on the border. It was a perfect location because it was right on the border of Georgia and this breakaway region, which was kind of the seat of this conflict, which was the very heart of this conflict when the Soviet Union collapsed. So American Corners really helped us gather these students, both from Georgia and from Gali, a city in Abkhazia, this breakaway region. And they spoke very good English. We kind of, the American Corners really helped us bring the students together and brought some excellent, excellent students.
And these were teenagers?
Yeah, they were in high school, so I guess the average age would be 15 or 16.
Yeah. So, I mean, this is a question that every good teacher probably asks, which is, what is the relationship between what we're studying in class and real life? And the whole point, I think, of choosing the Aeschylus, choosing Greek tragedies, choosing the theme of revenge, was for students to make that relationship.
Exactly.
How did that actually go? I mean, one of the things about the St. John's method is you don't tell them what to think.
Right. That I think is what really made this project, why I'm so proud of this project, because we came in not having, we didn't want to teach them an ideology, we didn't want to teach them these are the steps to make peace in your country or any of that. We just wanted to do the seminar style and let it work. And it did. For instance, one example is after the seminars and then after one of the visits to the refugee camp, one of the students said, well, I've always wanted to be a psychologist and I'm really interested in human mind, but once I graduate and become a psychologist, I'm going to practice at refugee camps for free. And so they really understood taking the text and that just understanding it or thinking about it isn't enough, but causing action and following up is really important.
And we certainly asked questions to kind of prompt them and make them try to see how there was a very direct connection between Aeschylus and the Oresteia to what the conflict what the conflict is and in Georgia. And So it was really interesting. I mean, the first seminar, everybody was kind of shy, and so there wasn't too much talking. And we were actually having a hard time trying to get them to just kind of come out and share their opinions, because it's a very difficult text. And the second seminar, which was the Thursday of the first week, everybody was talking. They were all very excited to discuss the book and kind of discuss some of the characters and talk about that. And it wasn't quite, we weren't quite there yet with that seminar in terms of connecting to the real issues. But it was really in the second week when we started asking more questions, they were comfortable with the seminar format, and we started to say, well, you know, how is the chorus like, you know, a citizen, a class citizen, in Georgia or anywhere?
Right.
And so to get them to ask questions and to try to think about how revenge and how do we solve revenge, how do we solve conflicts, like or unlike what's going on in the book.
And I think one thing that I was really impressed with, because in the first seminar and towards the beginning in the first week, a lot of them were saying, like, well, Agamemnon is right because it must be this way.
Mm-hmm.
But then towards the end, they started figuring out for themselves, like, revenge and these decisions might be more complicated than they think, and having a directive of must might be a stronger claim than they want to make.
Mm-hmm.
So they really changed.
If Aeschylus is walking around upstairs somewhere, he must be smiling.
We hope so.
Yeah.
I mean, think about writing tragedies and knowing in some way that 2,000 years later or more, whatever it is, people are actually still not only reading them and acting them, but using them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So you taught the seminar, and then you did these conflict resolution training classes. How did those work? What did they look like? Who was involved in them?
Sure. Our team member who's not here, Bilsana Bibic, she's a St. John's student. I think she'll be a senior this year.
Yeah.
She was in charge of the mediation and the conflict resolution trainings. And so she did a really great job, and she did like 2 days of lecture of the theory between conflict resolution and being open and considering all views, and that in conflict, no party is completely at fault and one not completely at fault. So when there's conflict, both sides have to realize that they have a stake in it. And then she did a lot of role-playing and games and things like that.
And one thing that I think worked really well, too, was that, you know, we weren't talking about issues like, how do you solve an issue between one nation and the other? I mean, we just took it really basic.
Yeah.
Like, how do you solve an issue between two classmates? And
over,
you know, she cheated on your homework, or
okay.
You know, she looked. And so how, you know, you're coming together, how do you solve an issue peacefully and so that both parties forgive each other? And so
right.
What we were hoping to do with that is to show them, first of all, how difficult it really is and how there are different sides to each story. And the students got really into it and created some really interesting scenarios. And by the end of these trainings, we had four of these, I believe. They, you know, some of the people who we had all volunteers, the people who volunteered to be the mediators, really were starting to see how to like get at the story beneath it and how to try to bring the parties together peacefully and resolve the issue.
Now, was it the same students taking the seminar as were in the conflict resolution?
That's right. Yeah.
Group.
Yeah.
Okay.
It was a group of 20 kids overall.
Who did the whole thing?
Right.
Now, you did that, and then you went to these refugee camps. Now, first of all, tell us a little bit of the background and history. Who are these refugees? Why are they there? How long have they been there? What's going on?
Know me with that one?
Sure. Yeah. Terry was kind of in charge of the medical section, but I'll briefly say some of the history is that when we say refugee camps, I mean, I'll clarify a little bit, is that they're not tent cities like you would see in, you know, pictures on the internet of like Rwanda or something. I mean, the conflict has been, it's not an open conflict. There was some simmering in 2008 during the war in South Ossetia that Russia got involved in. But for the most part, the conflict between Russia and Georgia has been stagnant since 92. So it's basically a 20-year conflict that's been going on. And these refugees...
What are they conflicting over?
Well, the conflict is that Georgia has always wanted Abkhazia to be part of Georgia. And at one point they were, very briefly. But Georgia now sees an issue because Russia has bases. Abkhazia is broken off from Georgia currently, and they're their own region. And Russia has bases inside of Abkhazia. So Georgia's technically a occupied country.
And is it a country officially?
Georgia?
No, Abkhazia.
Abkhazia. It's not recognized by the United States, but it is by Russia. So it's a de facto, has a de facto government. And so the conflict is really between countrymen. It's between Abkhazians and Georgians.
And are they ethnically mm-hmm. the same? Do they speak the same language?
They do speak the same language. Abkhazia does have their own separate language as well. But that's kind of found around Georgia. The region we were in is Samogrelo, and they have their own language, Mogrelian. So there's a number of different kind of versions of Georgian around the country. So it's a very rich country, despite how rich culturally, despite how small it is. So the refugee camps have been there for a very long time. So they're now just large concrete structures with no heating or air conditioning, of course, and sometimes without windows. The worst one that we went into used to be an old pharmacy manufacturing plant. And when the pharmacy got out, they left bottles, broken glass, what have you, and many of the refugees, kids especially, who have been playing in the basement where all the bottles were stored, have been poisoned. So the conditions are pretty dire and pretty hard very hard to fathom. And the thing is that they're within Zugdidi. They're within the town we were in.
And nobody knows they're there.
Right.
And that's the thing. These students who are 15 years old have grown up with the refugee camps in their city. And it's normal. So going in was really something new to them. And Terry can, I think, speak more.
Yeah. And so, I guess as far as the refugees, they were fleeing Abkhazia, and then they were welcomed into Georgia. But now they can't go back to Abkhazia because their homes and all of their belongings were just destroyed once they left. And the border is a strict border where they don't let people go back into Abkhazia. The refugees, they need, they're not camps, but these buildings are pretty decrepit. Some of the walls that separate like one family from another are just made out of like cardboard, just stuck together. And especially the one that doesn't have windows, it gets wet and moldy. And they spend so much of their time, I would imagine, just trying to keep up a living condition. Mm-hmm. And most of them don't have like running water or portable water. And they don't have restrooms. Every one that we went to, their bathroom is just an outhouse,
and
it doesn't have like a toilet seat. It's just a hole mm-hmm. in the ground. So the sanitation levels are really low.
And are they working in the town that you were staying in? Is there any mobility out of these places? I mean, if they've been there a long time.
Right. That's a really good question. It depends on the families, but kind of the gist of what I understood is they try to and they want to work, but Zugdidi isn't very kind to them as far as offering them jobs. And if they do get a job, it's really low paying.
Yeah, many of the refugees are out of work and, you know, receive as I heard from one woman who talked to, received like a pension of something like 70 lari per month, which is like $50 American dollars. But the thing is that there's no program to help these people.
There's no aid. How are they living?
Well, most of them are just do it themselves. You know, they've piped, you know, when this first refugee camp that we went to, the old pharmacy, they had piped in their own water. And so kind of because of semi-permanent to permanent conditions that they're living in, they've kind of just dealt with the situation. So it's definitely, it's not a very happy situation. and the students were visibly affected by it.
Yeah.
And that was what was really, of course, we weren't happy to see them affected by it, but we were really, you know, the point was made, I think, that here are people living in your town. These are your countrymen. and this is the effect of war.
Yeah.
And so bringing it really up close and personal was important for us to do.
Now, you brought medical supplies in. By the way, we're talking about the project Planting the Tree of Peace in Georgia with St. John's students and graduates Noam Freshman and Terrence Manning. You brought in medical supplies. Did you know in advance what was needed or had a pretty good guess? Or
yeah. Well, Elena Gavilia's parents, luckily, one's a doctor and one's a pharmacist. So they had a pretty good idea of what the conditions were like and what the types of medicines that the refugees would appreciate and be able to use. So we used their advice on that.
And so what did you bring in, for example?
So actually a lot of pretty things that would be, pretty common over-the-counter medications that would be here, but for there, they just can't afford them.
Aspirin and bandages, that kind of thing?
Yeah, aspirin, cotton, and then like some antihistamines for allergies, definitely some blood pressure medication, they have like a herbal type of medicine that they use from Russia to maintain their blood pressures and things like that. And then for each camp, we brought in a blood pressure cuff and stethoscope, so that they could have one in community and monitor their blood pressures. Because that heart disease seems to be one of the big problems.
Right. How did they respond when you guys, Americans, students, showed up saying, hi, we're here?
Yeah. Well, each camp had its own kind of environment and their own way of welcoming us. I think generally it wasn't a warm reception. And I don't blame them because they've been promised many things by many people and many government things. And we just came in and told them, we're here to help. We're not here to make any promises. This is what we can give you. We can give you doctors. We can give you these medicines. And then please talk to our students and give them your story so that they can prevent anything from like this ever happening again.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they weren't... I guess I would characterize it as more shy than hostile. One of the people in the camps was saying that that people had come to visit them before and had asked them about their living situation and had seemed to be very concerned, but nobody had ever come back. And so when we did scout out these locations with Elena and some doctors, and we ended up coming back, they were probably surprised a little bit.
Yeah.
But most of them, by the end of our time there, they were appreciative, and we used these medical kits that we gave to them, each family in the refugee camps as a kind of icebreaker for the students. So the students were really in charge here, and they were passing out the kits and asking questions.
Because of course they spoke the language.
They
and
spoke,
you didn't.
And we didn't, right? Yeah. So we were, you know. We were trying to.
I wish I could have practiced more medicine there, but the language I couldn't.
Yeah, it was. It's a tough language to learn.
Yeah,
I learned how to order the bill. That's.
And so, are the students having now an ongoing relationship with the people in the refugee buildings?
Yeah, one of the things that really was terrific when we were leaving is as the students had gotten together after our project, I think it was a day or two after that we finished the project, and were applying for their own grant to help some of these refugees. On Facebook, they just created a group, and they're doing elections within themselves, within this group of students, for who should, you know, lead the group. And so that, you know, the idea of planting the Tree of Peace in Georgia was, you know, exactly that. We would plant something. This would be the start of something, not the end.
Right.
And so it was extremely heartening to see these students who we really grew to love, to see them continue and to take they're 15, 16 years old, but they're taking the future of their country in their hands, which is exactly what we wanted to do.
And the project that they're working on involves some of the refugee children and vulnerable children of Zugdidi.
So these are the civic leaders of, I was going to say tomorrow, but really today, they're already doing it.
Yeah, yeah. So, yeah, like Noam said, like, our whole idea was to, that these 20 students, as that would go through each part of our project, they were what, I mean, we were planting in them so that they can make grow a tree of peace in Georgia.
Right, right.
And they're already doing it like 2 days. Like, we just unexpectedly showed up to the American Corner and they were there like filling out grant forms. It was amazing.
Amazing.
Yeah.
So what's your next step, if any?
Yeah, well, we're hoping to stay in touch with them. Many of us, you know, like I said, we grew to just become very fond of these students. Facebook is great. I mean, I've sent messages back and forth between them, and of course there's email. And so we're hoping to keep in touch. You know, one of their ideas, we had this political conference at the end where we invited political leaders and veterans of this war together to talk to the students. And the conversation actually, it was held in a kind of town hall format. And the conversation between the adults and the students actually went terribly. the adults were yelling at each other and interrupting, and you couldn't hear each other, and the students were asking questions. And by the end of this two-hour-long discussion between the students and the adults, the students were, you know, getting up and saying to the adults, you know, we're young. We're just students, but we're asking you questions, and you're not answering them. And I think for them it was a real wake-up call to, you know, they had seen that when we had been encouraging them, and they had seen the benefits of listening and talking to each other in discussion and dialogue. We had showed them the refugee camps and the situation there, and then they got to see firsthand why the conflict hasn't been resolved. It's because nobody is talking to each other, and is being realistic about what to do moving forward.
And it just goes to show once again that all big problems ultimately reside in human relationship failures of one kind or another.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah. And I guess it is pretty hard to listen, to like actively listen in the way that this needs to be done in Georgia. Mm-hmm. But I think the students really saw how powerful that can be.
Well, and you are also, if I understand correctly, showing the students how to look at, for example, history from multiple points of view.
Yeah. Yeah, that was another part of the project. I guess I overlooked on the overview earlier. But, and they had a history professor come in also to kind of be an expert and show different sides of the histories.
Yeah, you showed both the Abkhazian side and the Georgian side. And that was with Elena, and that was all in Georgian. So Elena said it went well, so I trust her.
So the two of you were watching. And Right.
Taking pictures. You know.
Right. Well, the project is called Planting the Tree of Peace in Georgia. Now, were you going to actually plant a real tree?
Well, that was kind of my hope, my dream. It wasn't actually a part of the proposal in the beginning, but I did kind of ask around, where can I buy a tree? Where can I buy a sapling? And I guess you can only buy them in the spring.
Right.
So I wasn't able to find a tree, but it would have made a nice cap to the end of the project. But that's okay. You know, we did what we wanted to do with the students. So.
The project is Planting the Tree of Peace in Georgia. Noam Freshman is a junior at St. John's College. Terrence Manning is a graduate of the St. John's College Graduate Institute. Thank you so much for being with us. And if people want to follow up on this, is there a website or a Facebook page they can be looking at?
Yeah, you can always go onto our website. You can. It's kind of a long title. It's just plantingthetreeofpeace.weebly.com, or you can look up on Google Planting the Tree of Peace, and it's the first hit. We have some blog entries also from our experiences there. The students did write up a political document for things, promises, and hopes for what they wanted to do in the future. So that'll be on the website very shortly if people want to take a look at that.
Well, thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thanks for having us back again.
I'd like now to welcome to the program Michael Smith. He's a retired chemist. He is a writer living here in Santa Fe. And he is teaching a workshop tonight. It's called Confluence, Patterns in Poetry, Mathematics, and Nature at the Genoveva Chavez Community Center. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thanks, Mary Charlotte.
So you are a chemist and you are a writer, very interested in poetry and very interested in the connections between the underlying mathematical patterns in nature and the beauty that we see around us, whether it be in images or in writing. And on some level, I have to say, it's a deep mystery to me why the things that we see as beautiful, like poems or flowers or mountains, are so describable in the language of mathematics.
Well, mathematics is just one of many languages, like Spanish, Italian, Norwegian, Cambodian. It has a particularly powerful twist to it in its ability to describe and predict.
What do you mean?
I can take a mathematical formula, say from physics, and throw a baseball in the air and predict where the ball would land. Okay, that might be more difficult to do, the prediction side of it, to do in any other language. But mathematicians and scientists have agreed upon a construct of what mathematics is. And for example, the number one means exactly that, one. It doesn't mean 14. So there's that power of agreement built into it.
Is all mathematics based in nature? So when you think of one, you think of, one apple or one toe or whatever. One, you think of a unit that you can see and pick up or whatever. Is all mathematics like that?
Boy, that's a really good question. I don't know the answer to that one. I do know that oftentimes in the sciences, the mathematical equations, theoretical equations, will lead to experimental observations. So in a sense, the mathematics leads the observation.
That's very interesting. So people figure out stuff in theory that turns out to have a practice rather than the other way around.
And turns out to exist. For example, in the news last week of finding the Higgs boson,
right,
which was predicted 50 years ago. The mathematics predicted it. This goes on and on. One of the famous scientists from the turn of the century predicted the neutron in mathematics and the existence of the neutron. And it wasn't shown until 50 years later.
Amazing.
That the neutron existed. But the mathematics showed it had to be there in order for an atom to be stable.
So you have these mathematical patterns and these mathematical constructs like pi, mm-hmm, or many other things that you learned maybe in geometry class or in high school math or maybe in college calculus or whatever. What does that have to do with poetry?
Well, many of the poetic forms are based in or have a mathematical form behind them. For example, a haiku. Let's just start with something that we think is simple. Haiku typically has 17 syllables. 575.
Although I've heard that in Japan they don't really stick to that as closely as we do here in translation land.
Well, when it comes to forms, beginning writers tend to think that they have to stick to the form.
Right.
But oftentimes the beauty in a haiku or in a sonnet is a slight disruption in the form, and that it's pleasing to the ear. Number one. Number two, just, literarily it makes more sense.
So, back to the haiku. You've got 17 syllables.
All right, 575, prime numbers. Okay, what's special about this? I don't know, to be honest with you. However, when the Japanese developed the form, it must have been pleasing to the ear. There was some symmetry there.
And so the thing is, and this is where the skeptic in me says, a line in poetry is pleasing to the ear because it's a prime number, give me a break.
No, because the syllable count is a prime number.
I know, but why?
I don't know. I don't have the answer to that question. The best that I can answer that question is that we're products of nature. And perhaps one can make an argument nature is a product of the underlying mathematics. Nature has to satisfy the mathematics. If it doesn't, then it doesn't exist.
So the workshop you're giving tonight is, it's an introduction to patterns in poetry, mathematics, and nature, and it's about poems about special numbers and Fibonacci poems. So talk about poems about special numbers. There are people who've actually written poems about pi, 3.14159265, whatever it is.
Yes, Wisława Szymborska, the Polish Nobel laureate in literature, wrote a beautiful poem about pi, and it's just titled Pi.
Do you want to read it?
Yeah, well, it's lengthy. I'll read a couple of lines from it, but first let me introduce pi.
Okay.
Pi is, if we take any circle and divide the circumference of the circle by the diameter, we get the number pi. It doesn't matter the size circle. We get the same number. To me, that's poetry in and of itself. There's something special about circles. No other geometric form, to my knowledge, has something like this. If you take a rectangle and divide the length by the width, you're going to get a different number depending upon the size of the rectangle.
Right.
The only case that I can think of where that would be true would be a square. And then length divided by width is 1.
Right.
And doesn't matter.
And there are certain kinds of rectangles that have a particular proportion to.
The golden rectangle.
Which is something I
would talk about in later workshops because there's the mathematics to the golden rectangle.
Exactly. And the golden rectangle is a particularly beautiful to look at shape, which is also like, really? Are you sure? Why?
I don't have the answer to that.
Yeah.
It's just the way it is. But it's something artists have capitalized on.
Right.
Right? Okay. So anyway, pi is an example of what's called an irrational number. It can't be written in a fractional form. So, for example, 0.5 can be written as 1/2, 5/10, 5,000 over 10,000.
Right.
Okay, there's a decimal equivalent to the fractional form. Pi doesn't have a fractional equivalent to its decimal form, so it's called an irrational number. It just goes on and on and on.
It goes on forever.
It's been calculated to 5 billion or 7 billion digits
right.
using supercomputers, and people are still trying to do this. There's good reasons to do that calculation in number theory.
Really?
Yeah. Uh-huh. But it turns out if pi has a repeating pattern to it, if it ends up showing to have some repeating pattern to it.
It hasn't yet.
This may lead to other discoveries in science or fundamental understanding about the universe. But so far, it doesn't have a repeating pattern.
Right.
Which is a beauty. You can't predict what the next digit's going to be at all. So anyway, this poem by Wisława Szymborska, with the idea that pi just keeps going on and on and on. I'm just going to pick it up in the middle of the poem. It goes on across the table, through the air, over a wall, a leaf, a bird's nest, clouds, straight into the sky, through all the bottomless, bloated heavens. Oh, how brief, a mouse tail, a pigtail, is the tail of a comet. How feeble the stars ray, bent by bumping up against space. And then she ends the poem. It's far from final. 7, nudging, always nudging a sluggish eternity to continue.
So we're talking to Michael Smith about his work on confluence, patterns in poetry, mathematics, and nature. And you spoke a little while ago about how you have theoretical mathematics that ends up, we find out later, has analogs in reality. and in physics and so on. Do you find that there are poets who come up with ideas that turn out to have analogs in physics and mathematics?
I haven't encountered any, but we know that science fiction writers have been very good at this over the last century. This is not to say that poets haven't trod ground before that hasn't been trodden by others. Somewhere in the depths of my brain, I recall a reference there of poets walking on that earth first.
Right.
And that the scientists...
And artists as
and,
well.
And artists, yeah.
Visual artists.
Yeah. And let me add a caveat here. Often when I say poets, I'll... In my space, I'm thinking visual artists, musicians too. Back somewhere in the recesses of my brain, someone has this beautiful quote out there of poets and artists walking on the ground first, and then the psychologist discovering it, and then the scientist.
Right. Yeah. Which is, it makes one wish that they would all talk to each other a whole lot more.
Yeah. Yeah. And in a sense, this is one of the things I'm trying to do with my workshops is to open up the discussion and to bring more people in. So, I hope artists show up. I hope scientists show up. I hope anyone who just has a curiosity about anything like this shows up.
Now, you are teaching tonight about poems about special numbers and also what are called Fibonacci poems. And the Fibonacci sequence was made famous perhaps by what I would call the worst novel of its time, The Da Vinci Code, but it was in terms of how it was written and everything, but it was very compelling to so many. It was made into a movie. What is the Fibonacci sequence?
Well, the Fibonacci sequence is based on something called Pascal's Triangle, which I won't go into. At the workshop, I talk about Pascal's Triangle. It has it's a beautiful series of numbers that is very predictive in the world of mathematics. But if you take Pascal's triangle and do a little bit of manipulation to it, you get the Fibonacci sequence. And the Fibonacci sequence starts with the two numbers 1 and 1. And then the next number is 2.
Because 1 and 1 is 2.
Yeah. So if you add 1 plus 1, you get 2, which is the next number of the sequence. If you add 1 plus 2, you get 3, which is the next number in the sequence. If you add 2 plus 3, you get 5. 3 plus 5 is 8.
And so on.
Okay. It sounds like a cute thing to do.
Right. It's the kind of thing that you do when you're bored in class in the third grade.
Yeah. Yeah. So a bunch of third graders have discovered the Fibonacci sequence.
I mean, seriously.
Undoubtedly. It turns out that the Fibonacci sequence is replicated in nature. For example, in the packing of seeds in a daisy or in a pine cone. In the way a pineapple arranges its petals. In all these cases, the petals, the seeds, are arranged in spirals. And if you count up the number in the spiral and work your way out, imagine being in the center of the daisy and working your way out, the succeeding layers in the spiral are a Fibonacci number. In the sequence. Now,
so it turns out there's one little seed in the middle, and then there's 2, and then there's 1 plus 2 is 3, and then there's 5, and then there's...
Yeah. 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 And the spirals work themselves in clockwise and counterclockwise directions.
Right.
And it's still a Fibonacci sequence. Now, of course, every daisy's not going to be this way. Every pine cone's not going to be this way. There's going to be some variation. But
just like there's variations in the haiku.
Right.
As we talked about earlier.
Yeah. But the majority of them are. All right. People figured this out a long time ago. And perhaps that someone wrote down the Fibonacci sequence and two people got together and compared notes and went, look at this.
Yeah. And so what are Fibonacci poems?
Well, a Fibonacci poem takes the Fibonacci sequence and can do one of several things with it. This one that's a favorite of mine by Michael Johnson, every line of the poem is a syllable count. along the Fibonacci sequence. So the first line has one syllable, the second line has one syllable, the third line has two, the fourth line has three.
And so on and
so on and so on and so on.
And does that, okay, so we see that that's true of this number sequence, we see that it's true of the inside of the daisy or the pine cone or the pineapple, when you look at it, and those things, I have to say, I mean, pineapples and the insides of flowers and pine cones really are very beautiful. Do the poems come out having that beauty to them just by using that number sequence?
In my mind, they do. Yeah. And as I tried to say earlier, or explain earlier, the sound of the poem, there's a rhythm to this. Poetry started out as a spoken form. And we talk, and perhaps as a dance form, and we talk about metrical feet, the number of syllables per line. And, you know, if people are dancing to a rhythm, it's easier to remember. There's something really satisfying about this. So, in this particular poem by Michael Johnson, Fibonacci Timelines, it's a description of objects in nature, and I wouldn't, as far as a poem, as far as a poem having a meaning or an underlying meaning, this one doesn't have it. But it's a beautiful description of objects that one might find.
Do you want to, so this is a Fibonacci poem that you're about to read.
Yeah, yeah. So I'll just read a couple. I'll just read the first six lines. Okay. Cat's claw curl, pine cone swirl, goat's horns turn, nautilus's shells homing out, pineapples whirl. And
that's to those syllables have those numbers.
Those lines have those syllable counts.
Right.
1, 1, 2, 3, 5, 8.
Et cetera.
Et cetera.
Yeah.
And the poem just grows and grows and grows.
Right.
Okay. And of course he has to stop it at some point.
Are there physical limits, or what determines the physical limits to, for example, you have a Fibonacci sequence occurring in nature, whether it be in a flower or a fruit or whatever, at a certain point it stops growing. It doesn't grow infinitely. What are the physical limits to that?
Well, I'm not a biologist or a geneticist, but certainly the amount of raw materials available.
Right.
The amount of energy, the amount of sunlight, water, nutrients, that
right.
kind of thing.
Which some analog of that would limit the length of the poem, too.
Right, right. And at some point you could imagine an organism getting big enough it couldn't feed itself.
Right.
So there are those kind of limits. If you want to extend this to a mountain chain, what's the limits to the size of a mountain chain growing? Gravity.
Right.
And erosion.
And it turns out mountain chains are also limited by, describable by fractals.
Mountains are described by fractal mathematics, which is something I'll talk about in a later workshop. There's a whole branch of poetry called fractal poetry. What a fractal is based on an equation that iterates itself, and you take an input, you put it into the equation, you get an output. You take that output, you put it back into the equation, you get another output, and it just keeps reiterating, reiterating, reiterating.
And that's a fairly simple mathematical formula, and it results in,
beautiful.
Mountain ranges, what else?
Coastlines, snowflakes, the rings of Saturn. All of these can be described by fractal mathematics. There's plenty of artwork that's Jackson Pollock's paintings have been, some of his paintings have been determined to have a fractal form.
You're kidding.
No. They've been digitized and then subject to computer analysis, and there's an underlying mathematical basis. He didn't realize this when he was doing it, of course.
Right.
But there's something
which
about
is, there's a beauty to that.
There's a beauty to that. Yeah, yeah.
Now, you are a chemist. You're a retired chemist. Did you come into this, all these analogs to art and poetry later in life, or was that part of the beauty of chemistry for you all along?
Well, back when I was an undergraduate, I had I wasn't sure if I wanted to be a writer or a scientist, and I went the technical route. Writing was always in the back of my mind. And then eventually, I think I developed enough life experience that I was able to tackle writing. And so I started writing about 12 years ago. And I just started writing poems. Of course, they weren't very good. But I did a lot of reading, took workshops, and just write and read and write and read and write and read. And so that's how I got into it.
Do you think, I mean, obviously, if you want to become a good writer, you have to do a huge amount of reading. It turns out maybe that looking at nature and internalizing mathematics and science might also help your writing?
Oh, no doubt about it. In my case, math and science just work their way into their poems through subtle metaphors. And for example, recently I just read, scientists have shown that the aurora borealis has a sound associated with it. We're just used to thinking of the aurora as being these pretty lights, right? But the aurora makes a sound. And I incorporated that fact into a poem.
Very interesting. Unfortunately, it's time to go, but we want to let people...
Infinity goes on.
Infinity.
Pi goes on. E goes on.
Right.
Yeah.
Oh, my goodness. Well, Michael Smith is a retired chemist. He's a writer, and he's teaching a workshop tonight at 7 o'clock at the Genoveva Chavez Community Center. And it's part of a larger series called Confluence, Patterns in Poetry, Mathematics, and Nature. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks, Mary Charlotte.